Okay, so good morning, everyone, and welcome to the panel. And the theme here is Embodied Expressions and Pleasures. And our first speaker this morning is Ida Dursa. Got it right. And Ida is a PhD candidate at the Centre for Research in Modern European Philosophy at Kingston University in London. Her research project critically traces the phenomenological notion of transcendence, such as it operates in Husserl, Levinas, and Merleau-Ponty. And it argues that transcendence works most basically at the level of bodily sensibility rather than consciousness or perception. And our paper this morning echoes this theme and looks at the possibility of and the ways in which bodies live desire prior to perception and reflection. So Ida's paper is titled Towards a Critical Phenomenology of the Erotic.
Thank you very much for that introduction. It's really nice to be here with you all. As the title of my talk suggests, today I'd like to begin to develop a critical phenomenology of the erotic through Merleau-Ponty and in dialogue with some of the feminist literature. In the abstract that I submitted to this conference, I wrote that I wanted to advance a phenomenological notion of sexuality, but I've since realized that that can be a bit misleading because the term sexuality is so intrinsically bound up with its psychoanalytic formulation. But given the fact that the bodily experience of the erotic is not necessarily informed or structured by knowledge of psychoanalytic theory, I don't draw on the psychoanalytic conception of sexuality here. This is, of course, not to say that a reading marrying psychoanalysis and phenomenology can be fruitful for conceptualization of sexuality, but this would require an investigation that far exceeds the scope of this paper. So where possible, I'll refrain from using the term sexuality and refer instead to the erotic, eroticism, and desire. Where the term sexuality does appear, I ask you to understand this not in its psychoanalytic specificity, but rather in terms of eroticism, such as this is lived phenomenologically. So without further ado, I'll begin. In the chapter on sensing in the phenomenology of perception, Merleau-Ponty, inadvertently challenging his thesis that perception is primary, points towards a dimension of bodily life that operates prior to perception. Sensibility designates the pre-reflective and pre-perceptual openness of the body to its world and to others. It's an anonymous dimension of bodily life, which operates structurally prior to the distinction between subject and object, and which is, as Alia Al-Sadji has recently argued, the generative ground of the ways in which we come to see, feel, and touch. As such, sensibility is never neutral, but is always already contextually dense. Sensibility then designates the ways in which, in Al-Sadji's words, and I quote, the political already structures experience at the lived pre-reflective level of felt embodiment, end quote. Building on recent critical work into this pre-reflective dimension of bodily life as developed by Al-Sadji and others, in this paper, I want to move towards a critical phenomenology of the erotic as operating in the modality of sensibility. I do this through the lens of Merleau-Ponty, reading the chapter on the body and its sex being in the phenomenology in dialogue with some of the feminist literature. Given that the move from perception to sensibility already takes us beyond Merleau-Ponty, my claim is not to discover a notion of the erotic that remains latent in his work and which he sought but failed to fully develop. My aim is rather to excavate and reappropriate elements of his phenomenology that can help us to develop a critical understanding of the ways in which human bodies live desire prior to perception and reflection. So Merleau-Ponty describes the erotic as an intentionality that follows the general movement of existence and that weakens along with it. It's an odor or an atmosphere which is coextensive with life. The erotic then is a pre-perceptual and pre-reflective life force that is irreducible to what's commonly understood by sexuality as sexual identity or orientation. The erotic is the bodily openness to the world and to others. It's like a mood in Heidegger's sense, a particular attitude that colours everything. The erotic describes, as Audre Lorde writes in Uses of the Erotic, a zest for life, an opening to the world, to oneself and to others, a capacity for joy, for friendship, for the pursuit of knowledge, of pleasure. By reading the erotic through the lens of sensibility and sensibility through the lens of the erotic, then we'll see that the erotic refers back to sensibility and that in fact there is an eroticism of sensibility itself. will thus expose a dialectical movement between the two chapters of the phenomenology, which in turn reflects the movement between sensibility and the erotic in life itself. My paper is divided into three moments. In the first moment, I analyze Merleau-Ponty's description of sexuality in the phenomenology, whilst at the same time responding to the feminist critique advanced by figures such as Judith Butler and Elizabeth Cross. These thinkers criticize Merleau-Ponty for presenting sexuality in a universalist, that is, a masculinist way, abstracted from the reality of gender difference and non-heterosexual identities. Insofar as Merleau-Ponty does not account for the ways in which different bodies desire differently, this critique is not unfounded, although it is somewhat misplaced. This is because Merleau-Ponty's analysis of sexuality, as I'll argue, rather than making a claim about the universalist character of desire, such as it must be for everyone, in fact makes a more basic claim about the strictly bodily, that is, the sensible dimension of our most intimate intercorporeal relations. Given this bodily character of the erotic, in the second moment, I argue that a condition for erotic encounters to be pleasurable, empowering, or transformative is precisely that each body abandon itself to being a body. The paradox, then, is that pleasure and empowerment require a certain passivity that is not pure receptivity or objectification, but rather the abandonment to being a sensible body. The difficulty of finding this balance between being a body without being objectified is, as Beauvoir writes, not universal in degree. Insofar as woman is already other, and I quote, she has to reconquer her dignity as transcendent and free subject while assuming her carnal condition. This is a delicate and risky enterprise that often fails, end quote. If the erotic describes something like the desire for life itself, not all eroticism, however, is specifically sexual. Merleau-Ponty's emphasis on the osmosis between sexuality and existence describes how the sedimentation of our history expresses itself concretely in our erotic relations and vice versa, how our erotic relations express a sense that is not merely sexual. The existential situation of women living in patriarchal society, then, expresses itself in various ways in women's relations to fleshy, carnal sex, as, for example, lack of desire and difficulty or resistance to abandoning oneself to the other. Vice versa, the repression of erotic desire or the experience of sexual violence often translates into other areas of bodily existence that are not predominantly sexual, for example, in the prevalence of chronic gut disorders amongst women who've suffered childhood sexual abuse. Going decisively beyond Merleau-Ponty and more properly into the critical dimension of a phenomenology of the erotic, then, the final section of my paper addresses the contextual structuring of the erotic itself. Whilst it makes sense that concrete experiences of sexual violence would have some bodily effect, it's less obvious how ideal structures like heteronormativity and patriarchy come to literally and materially structure the degree to which bodies are open or closed to erotic encounters. Does this happen purely at a cognitive or psychological level, or does it also happen at a bodily level? And can a critical phenomenology of the erotic help us to not only understand, but also empower the erotic lives of bodies? Okay, I'll move more probably into the first moment of the thesis. Merleau-Ponty analyzes the oscillation of existence and sexuality through the case of Johann Schneider, a war veteran injured by a piece of shrapnel to the occipital region of his brain. Throughout the phenomenology, Merleau-Ponty describes, through Goldstein and Gelb's examinations of Schneider, the different ways in which his injury has effectively flattened almost all aspects of his existence. We hear how he cannot perform abstract movements, such as touching his nose or reaching his arm out, that do not have a concrete aim other than the movement itself. We hear how his attempts to make new friends almost always fail because he's lost the ability to spontaneously interact with others, thus conferring on his movements and engagements a forced deliberateness. In his erotic life, too, he is above all disinterested. He never takes any sexual initiative. He doesn't kiss and doesn't find other bodies sexually attractive. In fact, Merleau-Ponty writes, the very word satisfaction no longer means anything to him. Merleau-Ponty argues that Schneider's sexual inertia is not the effect of a defect physiology or psychology, but is the expression, rather, of an alteration of, quote, the very structure of erotic perception or experience. End quote. Different from objective perception, Merleau-Ponty writes, I quote again, erotic perception is not a cogitatio that intends a cogitatum. Through one body, it aims at another body, and it is accomplished in the world, not within consciousness. End quote. Erotic perception then operates at the level of pre-objective sensibilities, such as we've described it, and Schneider's problem is precisely that he is confined to perceiving objects as abstracted from any effective, let alone specifically, erotic pull. Insofar as Merleau-Ponty writes, the visible body is underpinned by a secret sexual schema, then the visual perception of another body does not by itself generate sexual desire. Schneider is perfectly capable of seeing other bodies, but they do not express or mean anything to him. Thus, the visible contains as its own immanent excess an erotic pull which is suggested to the pre-objective erotic perception of another body, and the quote-unquote erotic comprehension at work here transcends any consciousness or even perception of it. Just as Merleau-Ponty in the chapter on sexuality argues that desire comprehends blindly by linking one body to another, in the chapter on sensing, he writes that the term that sensation intends is only recognized blindly through the familiarity of my body with it. The linking of bodies in erotic perception is then a blind process which implies a strange temporality. In order for my body to have an erotic encounter, my body must adopt a specific erotic attitude which it paradoxically receives from another body. The erotic attitude then cannot be willed or forced, for this is precisely what makes sexuality a problem for Schneider. He can only will himself to engage in an erotic situation and thus quickly loses any interest. A productive reading of the body and its sex being then shows that Merleau-Ponty's analysis of sexuality, whilst not accounting for the ways in which different bodies come to desire differently, nonetheless helps us to understand how bodies live desire at the level of pre-perceptual sensibility. A phenomenological notion of the erotic, then, describes how an erotic encounter, in Beauvoir's words, demands total abandon to being a body if the encounter is to be pleasurable or empowering. The paradox is that pleasure requires a certain passivity, a daring to give oneself over to one's desire, to one's body, and to the other. An erotic encounter, then, involves a certain loss of sovereignty as bodies that were once separate move closer to one another in their rhythm of binding, and the openness of bodies is a condition for pleasure to be experienced. It's precisely this openness, however, that makes bodies at once capable of intimacy and susceptible to violence. Whilst an erotic encounter is not unilaterally governed by structures of domination, objectification, or received ideas and norms prescribing how bodies should and should not move, look, or feel, this is not to say that these norms do not to a large extent structure the degree to which bodies are capable of the kind of abandon needed for the erotic encounter to be empowering. How then does gender and heteronormativity structure, impact, or inhibit the erotic lives of bodies at the level of sensibility? I'll address this question through an analysis of what's widely considered the most common sexual problem reported by women partnered with men, namely a lack of desire to engage in erotic sex at all. It should be said that I rely here on a heterosexual framework, as this is where most research has been done and due to the brevity of this paper. It's also important to note that the way in which women's lack of desire is conceived in both popular and scientific discourse largely reflects and reinforces the cliche according to which a low level of desire is a more or less natural trait of female sexuality compared to male sexual desire, which is presumed to be naturally high. Arguably, the fact that so many women partnered with men report a low level of desire to some extent reflects the common understanding of their male partners' typically higher level of sexual desire as the norm against which their own lack of desire stands out. In this regard, Rosemary Basson's responsive model for female sexual desire is significant in that it breaks with the idea that female desire is spontaneous. Instead, the responsive model emphasizes the secularity of sexual arousal, desire, and the context of the relationship. The model falls short, however, in its neglect of the wider historical contexts, which underlie and structure the internal dynamic of the model itself, given that, as Catherine Angel argues, Desire is rarely not responsive. It's just that we forget to think of certain conditions as context. We need to ask whether the contexts of patriarchy and heteronormativity are not unconducive to the elicitation of female sexual desire. Is there something inherently unsexy about the heteronormative gender roles which women partnered with men inevitably and unknowingly in one way or another take up? I ask this question neither to argue that a low level or lack of sexual desire is a problem in itself, nor to argue that the emancipation of female sexual desire entails its meeting the level of male sexual desire, not least given the fact that male sexual desire is no less contextually structured than female sexual desire. Rather, I ask this question to develop a better understanding of the ways in which bodies take up their historically specific situation and how this comes to structure the erotic lives of bodies. So the historically specific situation of women living in patriarchal society then is for many characterized by stress and anxiety about living up to impossible ideals and at having to negotiate the constant threat of sexual violence and objectification. In addition, women have historically invested a disproportionate amount of non-sexual erotic energy into the emotional and physical well-being of others, resulting in a deprioritization of their own desire or well-being. This is arguably still true. Women still take on a disproportionate amount of childcare, housework, and emotional labor compared to their male partners, and it often falls on the woman to remind their male partner of social gatherings and so on, resulting in women often taking on a maternal role in relation to their male partners. It's not, of course, that the maternal body is essentially de-eroticized, but that the relationship between mother and child is not one of erotic sex. Taking on a parental role in relation to one's partner then, whilst affective and caring, is essentially unsexy. If women take on a parental role in relation to their male partners in their everyday lives, this arguably translates into their erotic relations too, reflecting the normative idea that it's women's responsibility to satisfy their male partner's need for sex. Yet when women engage in erotic encounters, despite their lack of desire, they do it for the sake of their partners or the relationship, not for the sake of their own pleasure. This then takes the form not of an erotic encounter at all, but of a one-way provision of satisfaction. Whilst women are perhaps generally happy to be non-sexually intimate with their partners as they would with their child, erotic sex often becomes yet another responsibility women feel obliged to fulfill rather than something joyfully engaged in. The erotic life force of women then is often channeled into caring responsibilities to the extent that there is little, if any, left for the seeking of sexual pleasure. The enormous amount of energy that goes into mothering then only adds to the general stress characteristic of inhabiting a female body today. Whilst the degree to which bodies are capable of the kind of abandon required for erotic encounters is surely psychological, as the feminist emphasis on the internalization of patriarchal structures suggests, the social structuring of hormones such as cortisol perhaps indicates that this resistance to abandon also happens at a bodily level. Whilst chronic stress negatively impacts sexual desire in bodies of all sexes and genders, given that women report disproportionately higher levels of stress and anxiety compared to men, social neuroendocrinologist Sarah Van Anders suggests that, I quote, it perhaps makes sense that the chronic stress of women's heteronormative roles could be responsible for low desire, end quote. The closing off from the possibility of erotic encounters then is not merely a psychic resistance, but arguably also a bodily resistance, which is lived at the level of sensibility. Whilst I cannot feel my hormones fluctuating, my body nonetheless senses whether it's stressed and wants to be left alone, or whether it's curious and open to being touched and moved by its own or the other's desire. Recoiling from an otherwise beloved partner's touch is not only a psychical, but also a sensible response, a bodily resistance to being moved by the other. The way in which women's bodies take up their existential situation then translates into a kind of erotic indifference, similar but not reducible to Schneider's affective flattening. Gender normative ways of inhabiting a female body then cast woman, as Beauvoir teaches us, as other, yet not only as other to men, but as other to the erotic itself. It's obviously not the case then that women are inherently incapable of desire, but that the context of patriarchal society is generally not conducive to the elicitation of female sexual desire. To conclude, I hope to have begun to show how a critical phenomenology of the erotic can help us to understand how the structures of patriarchy and heteronormativity are taken up and perpetuated at the level of sensibility, and how this taking up structures the ways in which bodies live desire. In turn, such understanding prompts us to ask whether there's something bodies can do to step into this process of structuring. I ask this question not in order to encourage women to work to desire more. Certainly, if it really is the case that women are generally more stressed and that this inhibits their sexual desire on a physiological level, working to desire more will surely only add to the stress women already experience, thus only further inhibiting desire. It seems that women will not desire more until gender dynamics and societal structures become more egalitarian, which may in turn result in men desiring a bit less. Whilst desiring more is not and should not be an aim in itself, I cannot help but think that the restrictive situation of women deprives us of a certain enjoyment and pleasure, not only in our erotic encounters, but in other areas of our lives. Perhaps then it's not so much a case of desiring more, but of desiring differently. The opening up of other ways of desiring is perhaps connected with the desire for and curiosity about life itself. Daring in other non-sexual areas of our lives to be vulnerable, to lose control a little, may allow the erotic energy that essentially binds us to the world and other bodies to form new, unexpected, and non-conforming ways of desiring. Daring to be a body without judgment, a need for control or fear may elicit new forms of erotic desire and a reopening to others and to oneself. Thank you.